We are not heroes, nor are we villains, neither kings nor magicians, but we can tell you their stories. We are the Lore Keepers, and we welcome you to Hallowmay. Welcome to Hallowmay. You are listening to Lore Keepers, a lore building podcast where we talk about eons of history, heroes and villains, and the legends they leave behind. I'm Frank.
And I'm Carter.
And whether you're interested in stories, looking for inspiration in your own world building, or perhaps you want a piece of the action, we've got something for you. So this week, we are going to be talking about lycanthropy, or were creatures in general, probably focused on werewolves. But before we get into that, Carter, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Frank. I'm excited for August 15th.
What's on August 15th?
It's the next full moon, Frank.
Oh, yeah. That's... Do you have your wolf blind all set up in the woods, ready to spot those werewolves when they start coming around?
I do. I've got a steady supply of cat urine to keep me safe.
What?
Look, I don't know how werewolves
Frank, it's a part of all of the fantasy tropes. You know this. Vampires are afraid of wooden stakes, and werewolves stay away from cat pee.
Exactly. It's like garlic to them.
That's pretty great. I had no idea. Are there other things that they like to avoid?
Well, Frank, we need to do introductions first. We can't just go straight into the podcast.
Well, I was just curious. Okay, random side note, though. Have you seen What We Do in the Shadows?
I have not.
There's a whole episode devoted to werewolves versus vampires. It's directed by Taika Waititi, if you didn't know.
I do not.
He's the guy who did Thor Ragnarok, so...
Oh,
lots of credit to him. Yeah. Yes, it's extremely funny. But aside from the next full moon, is there anything else in your life that you're looking forward to?
I hope so. I just moved into a new place.
This is it. This is as good as it got for Carter last name.
Carter last name. I'm in a different state now. My phone just went off.
Your phone just went off?
Silence that, yeah.
Yeah, so you recently moved into a new college town.
Yep, I'm in the Palmetto State.
It's exciting, man.
Yeah, it's exciting. It is. I'm excited to start my, doctoral candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
Teach some kids about philosophy.
Yeah.
Kids, I mean, college students.
But you're getting to an age, though, where... freshmen and sophomores are absolutely kids.
I just feel bad calling 18-year-olds kids, but I guess, you know.
I really don't anymore. I mean, having graduated so far long
as
ago...
As a 45-year-old, Frank.
As a wizened old oak of a man, I...
Oh, gosh.
Look at people... I don't know, a few years younger than me. That's the thing, is at 26, somebody who's 18 is almost a decade younger than me. Their life looks entirely different, and their only context has been high school.
Yeah.
So I remember what I was at 18, and it's a different person than I am now.
You blanch.
Oh my god, dude. I mean, living in the dorms was excellent, because it was basically just nonstop slumber party with all your favorite friends.
That's one experience.
Yeah, well, that is one very specific experience that is mine. That's exciting, though, dude. I know you've been looking forward to this for a while, and the prospect of continuing your pursuit and exploration of philosophy and stuff, that's going to be super cool and very valuable to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm very excited for having a real job.
Right, yes, well... We'll talk about that when you graduate. good luck on that real job of yours. It's gonna be, it sure is gonna be there and real.
Yeah, but now I have a real job.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'm paid to teach kids.
As in teaching the kids. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Because you're getting paid to do that, which is excellent.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not gonna get a job after I do this. I retire, you know, at the hardy age of 27.
I understand now. I see.
And cry. Cry out, cry, and, you know, buy, I don't know, ramen with my food stamps and my unemployment benefit.
And when you can afford it, cookie dough in a tube to help console your tears.
Yep. Those beautiful tubes. But Frank, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I've been enjoying the summer. The days are wonderful. Oh gosh. Whenever you ask that question.
Is the weather good?
Don't you dare. Don't you do this to me. Honestly, the one thing that I'm thinking about right now. Oh, I should say, actually, yesterday, I spent a solid 5 hours focusing on the Sudarian map, the literal geographic map of the world. It's actually really useful. You can wrap it around Google Earth. And so I've been doing that to test to like see what it actually looks like when it's, you know, placed and when things get super warped, especially near the poles.
Yeah.
But dude, I have added wind patterns, the area like tornado and hurricane latitudes. I'm currently in the process of adding ocean currents. And the point of all of that is then to figure out where the climates are and what kind of climates are. Because even with just the ocean currents starting there, I'm figuring out what are the locations where fishing cultures would have started, which would have been the ones most likely to restart things. Especially, obviously, all of this is complicated by the true history of Sudar and Avum Prima, Avum Secunda, and stuff like that. But it's just very helpful for me to figure out when and where civilizations were picking up and stuff, and then what climates are affecting things. So it's all very exciting, and I had a huge amount of progress yesterday. So yeah, that's something. If people are interested, maybe I'll throw a couple of things online of on the Twitter feed of where the map currently is. It's a mess. There's like 65 layers on Illustrator and stuff, and the size of the map is, I think, 16,000 by 8,000 pixels, because I wanted to be able to zoom way, way in. It's been, 16,000 by 8,000 points, as in typeface size, but whatever.
Okay. Yeah. How about, how are the continental plates doing?
They are actually no longer accurate since I started to warp things to fit the Google Earth, so I actually need to shift those around and reevaluate where convergent zones and divergent zones and subduction zones and all that stuff is happening.
That'll tell us where our mountains are.
Yeah, which is actually very important for both weather and climate, and then also what kind of communities can survive in those areas.
Yeah, it tells us where the dwarves are.
Yeah. I don't know if you were asking that to to be jokey or not, but of course it's something I mean, that was the first thing I did, was put plate tectonics down.
The first thing. Before anything else, plate tectonics.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, anyways, so that's kind of in the past right now. It's my mind is all over the place, but I am excited to talk about our topic this week.
Which is plate tectonics.
Yep, plate tectonics. Which is just fun to say. Plate tectonics.
Which are a myth.
Yeah, everybody knows that it's not that the world is hollow, and it's not that the world is flat. Instead, it's actually that the North and South Pole are all part of the same pole, and the Earth, as we know it, is just one region on a much larger ice ball where there are giant cliffs of ice that we can't get through.
And you know what's underneath all that?
What?
Turtles. It's turtles all the way down.
Oh, dude, I started reading Terry Pratchett for the first time, some Color of Magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never explored that before.
But anyway, we're talking about lycanthropy, Frank.
Yes, we are. We're talking about werewolves, specifically.
Yes, not were-tigers, or were-bears, or were-rats, or were-ocelots.
Wear hairs.
None of that.
Well,
maybe a little.
We'll see, because that was one of my questions. And we'll get into that in a bit. But I think we should start. So Carter and I think we're excited to bring this back up. This is something we've been playing with. Especially recently, we discovered some stuff about the Moons, and we had a couple episodes in a chain that talked about the Moon Sisters. Specifically, episode 55 and 56, we're talking about heavenly bodies. We talked about Yadiel and then the Moons of Sudar. But in episode 56, we discovered some stuff about the fourth moon of Halume. And whenever you take lunar cycles and the moon into account, of course, the most pop culture thing that's associated with that stuff, aside from maybe astrology, is werewolves. And so then the question is how does that affect werewolves on Halume? And what is the Halumian werewolf that's different from and unique, distinct to all other? What's our take on it? So, Carter, where should we start? What would be a good place to begin?
I think we start with what a werewolf is, Frank.
Okay.
So, sure. A werewolf is a kind of being, a knowing, that has some kind of curse or disease, or diseased curse or cursed disease, wherein upon being exposed to a full moon or several full moons, they become shifted into a wolf-like form. How's that?
Pretty good. It's a pretty good description of a werewolf. Especially to specify the things that are associated with Halume. Yeah, so a couple of things that would be great places to begin, I think. Yes, so this is a good description of what a werewolf is, especially for those of you who don't know what a werewolf is. Hi, welcome to the 21st century. Here's a book, any book.
It's called Twilight.
Oh boy, what if that was somebody's first book they'd ever read?
I mean, it's a hell of a childhood.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just realized, imagine teaching somebody not with go, 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 dog, go, but with, I don't know, however Twilight starts, whatever the first words are on that page.
I don't know.
Anyways, so a couple of things, though. You mentioned how werewolves get to be. So is it a disease? Is it a curse? Is it a blood disease? Is it some sort of magic? Probably something to do with magic. Obviously, magic to do with any of this, but it could also be other things in addition.
I think we should look at some tropes and think about what we want to have in Halume.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, maybe through this we can see where it comes from.
Yes. I think one of the first things we should think about is the Halumian context here. So being, yeah, turning into a werewolf is not the same as turning into a wolf. Wolves are, I don't know if our werewolves can straight up a beast shape in the same way that a druid can, but that's actually one of the things that we should consider is this like an incomplete transformation? And is that what makes it different from wild shapes? Because the druids, the druids who related to Gaia and connected specifically the halflings of the Veldt, the ones who were the first druids, it seems like this is a different thing entirely than that. Even when we also consider other were creatures.
Yeah, I agree. I think
It's maybe like related, like there's a cousin thing going on, but I don't think it's like
they're all
the
shape
same
changers,
thing.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that it's they have at least the form. So there's a train.
Yeah, no, I said that's okay. It's actually kind of cool to know that there's now going to be trains in our podcast.
Yes. I'll go shoot you whenever they come by. They at least have the kind of like humanoid form where they're like wolves that stand up with like opposable thumbs.
Right, yeah. Well, I think this is true of, so when Carter mentioned were-tigers, were-rats, were-whatever else, those are things that are also in D&D as stat blocks. So, of course, our typical default is to look for ways to allow those to exist in Helmaine, to have a little bit more story behind where they came from and stuff if they pop up in a campaign. So there, we're also trying to do double duty here, though, in that the implications of figuring out, once we figure out some of where those came from, it might have bigger implications about other were creatures and maybe other societies around them. Is this something that is large enough or often enough occurring that you have communities? Especially when you have werewolves, I think the idea of wolf packs are very intrinsic to the trope. I think it's something that people can communicate with. It's a sense of outcast community. And I would like to keep that when we consider our werewolves. And so one of my first thoughts is, what I think, if we're talking about origins of where werewolves come from in Halime, what I think it is not is from some sort of lab experiment gone wrong. I think this is much more a magic thing.
I agree.
Even if it was a magic experiment gone wrong, I like the idea of relating it back to the druids and the idea of old blood.
Yes.
Maybe there's something in, like, these were outcasts of the druids or something like that.
Yes. So who were our first druids? The halflings?
Yeah, yeah. Canonically, the first druids were halflings. They were the ones who discovered the Veldt and in it and through it discovered and started to disseminate nature magic, because there was only, that was really the last place that there was a powerful source of magic during Avum Secunda, which, if you're new to the podcast, is just, it means Second Age, and it is a time when magic had fled from Sidar the world, basically leaving a dry Mad Max-esque or Conan the Barbarian-esque landscape that was blasted and devoid of anything beyond the dictatorial hierarchy of a single empire.
So maybe there's a schism in the halfling community that caused one portion of them to be cursed with this shifting condition.
Yeah. Okay, so there's, yeah, the curse. Is it considered a curse? Is it considered a blessing? Do our werewolves go ape when they, do they just go ham? I guess ape is maybe a, anyways, do they go crazy when the moon is out just killing anything, or do they still retain some level of their sense of self?
So I think one thing that's interesting is that werewolves in D&D are considered to be chaotic evil.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I think that we would probably adjust that. I think there's probably a predominance of chaotic evil, but that might just be the way that society perceives them.
Yeah, and it may not be that they have to be chaotic evil, but I like to keep the idea of, like, they're not great things. Like,
yeah.
It's not like you see a friendly werewolf. It's like these things are, maybe there's some kind of madness associated with it, and that, you know, the exception is the werewolf who can keep their mind.
Yeah. I think maybe here's how I'd put this. I think that werewolves in Halume are chaotic evil in the same way that the Incredible Hulk is chaotic evil, which is, it depends on your perspective and maybe on your Hulk. The Marvel Cinematic Universe Hulk is actually, there's a whole arc there, but does that make sense? In that, like, it's not necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily perceive that he is chaotic evil, and we as the viewer wouldn't necessarily, but in Age of Ultron, when he takes down that skyscraper and stuff, there are definitely people in nearby blocks or whatever who would only ever see him as that way for the rest of their lives, and would say, yes, he is chaotic evil. It's like a sickness that they're fighting, I think, is what I'm trying to get at here. I think that the werewolfness comes with it levels of unbridled fury or
hunger, maybe.
Yeah, like a psycho, like just, yes, a hunger that borders on psychosis to continue to, you know, feed the beast, all those ideas and tropes. I think that that is connected to and reinforces the chaotic evil side of them. And if they're not that, it's because they're trying very, very, very hard to work against their disease or affliction or whatever it is.
Oh my gosh. I got an idea.
Yeah?
So let's go back a little bit to the halflings, right?
Okay.
And, you know, they were a very tight-knit community. It mm-hmm. was, you know, very much a kind of, you know, socialism, sharing resources and making sure everyone's good, right?
Yeah. With, I will add this just because I think I know, I'm excited to figure out where you're going, but I will say there is a interesting dichotomy there where on the one side, yes, they were extremely, these are not halflings like the hobbits were. They're more naturalist. They're more building their homes in the trees and things, or not necessarily high up in the trees, but among the trees. But simultaneously, I guess they did have pasture land and stuff, but simultaneously they were also extremely aggressive towards outsiders. They would kill yeah. anybody who tried to enter the Veldt. Very
they're,
protective.
They're very and, xenophobic. And
yes, they were xenophobic socialists.
Yeah, so they were communists.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sorry, but, go ahead though.
Yeah, so what if, given their tendency to be a bit extreme in the violation of law,
mm-hmm.
trespassing, mm-hmm. what if there was a family that hoarded food and would not ever tithe to the community?
So was this an outcast family of halflings that were no longer a part of the Veldt?
Well, no, I think that they were like a core part of the Veldt, and it was like a big family, and it was revealed through, like, you know, a big,
oh,
maybe a traitor
okay.
in the family or something, that they had
sure.
this like wealth of food and, you know, maybe medicinal herbs or like whatever that they just did not share, even though it was like a really bad winter or something.
Yeah.
And like, it was an outrage and they were, and maybe they were cursed and outcast to always be hungry.
Seen almost as, I like this. Okay, I like this narrative that you're building here, especially because the Veldt only survived because of intense, careful, thoughtful planning. They had the advantage of doing that in the way that a lot of other peoples suffered under the affliction of soullessness during this time. They were fortunate enough to continue to sucker on magic during this whole time. And I think their numbers were never large. You know, I imagine that this community was maybe no larger than a few hundred at any given point. And so that as a result, the halfling population remained steadily small because it was the only way to survive, was never produce more people than you can produce of food. And so there was this extremely tenuous balance. And so the idea of one family looking out for themselves was like the ultimate, it would be seen as worse. Yeah, it'd be seen as worse than, like, I don't know, like sexual assault or something. I don't know, like worse than anything else is the idea of hoarding or not sharing.
Yeah, it's like the only other bannable or outcastable offense is like maybe murder or like bringing an outsider in.
Yeah, it's like worse than death because it's like death to the living. It is yep. saying that you endanger our very existence with your actions. Anyway, so it'd be a bad thing. Which, side note, if y'all are wondering what the Veldt is or curious as to what we're talking about, just check the podcast description. We've included a reference there to what it is we're talking about here. So I like this. I like this narrative. I think that this is sort of the terrestrial or non-magical side of this. What I'm curious about is, when we look at Gaia, as this is kind of forever ago, I don't remember specifically when we talked about it. If we did, it's also in the podcast description. But Gaia and Najani, the natures of the spirit of the world and the sky, are the two sort of lowercase g gods of Sidar that sort of remained when the threads were cut to the Ethereum, right?
Yeah.
We also, in this situation, have the Moon Sisters. And I'm curious to know, the Moon Sisters, which are Hadariel, Gamaliel, Mayan, and Fenislil. Fenislil no longer being around for reasons explained in a previous episode. What I'm curious is, how do those come into the idea of the magic? So the magic of, especially because, one other thought here, Wild Shape in D&D is known as the Circle of the Moon. Right, yep. Exactly. And so what I'm curious is I think maybe this is maybe also a question of sort of the druidic family tree, if you will,
so
of different circles and how they were born. I think there's the circle of the land was the first one.
Yes.
With Gaia. And I do hear want to hear your question. I just need to get this out because otherwise I'll lose it. But I want to know how the moon comes into this. If the circle of the moon came first or if lycanthropy came first. If there is some sort of narrative there where we can weave into this family curse or if it is a curse or, you know, what happened there that the moon becomes maybe, you know, a part, an element in this story. The moons, I should say.
Maybe, given our discussion of light and how it's a carrier of magic, we can fix it.
Right.
This. So,
also in the podcast description, it's in the episode about Yadiel.
So, this is my idea. Lycanthropy came first, but halflings had discovered a method of ritual casting certain spells, relying on the light of the moon sisters.
Okay.
Because it was less harsh, and they could maybe split it easier than the light of the sun. And, you know, they could use their souls as a kind of prism or something like this. Or maybe they had special, you know, trees or something aided them in this ritual that couldn't be done by the light of the sun.
Yeah. Okay, I think there might be something there, because here's another thought, something that we've never really discussed before, but we assume that there must be something going on, is that this whole time, the Veldt has stuck around, and we've never really explained why the Veldt remains verdant when everywhere else in the world is not.
Well, one of the ideas was it was like the location of the dead body of Gaia.
That's right. Okay, so maybe that, thank you for reminding me of that. That's right. So we did have that thought. I'm kind of wondering, so a little side, we might actually have to step aside for a second here because I'm curious. I think I'd come out under the impression that Gaia was the combined networking of all living creatures, sort of the anima god.
Yeah.
Right? So then...
That's different from animus.
Right. Anima is the animating force, the impulse, if you will, of instinct. What is it then to have a body?
Talking about Shone again.
What'd you say?
We're going to talk about Shone again or whatever his name is.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about Shem in this situation. Shem. Unless maybe that does come in, but I'm not necessarily trying to get that esoteric. I guess what I just meant was I had always seen Gaia as not something corporeal, but more... It's not something corporeal any more than you can point at something and say, there's the internet. I saw it as, yeah, as like a connection between all the different anima in the world. And so as a result, it's more of a network, being as network than being as having a body.
Yeah, what I imagine is that's how Gaia is now, but prior to, maybe they had enough power to manifest as an avatar.
Okay, so there was like a becoming.
Yeah, basically. I think that because back in the day, you know, when everything was nice,
mm-hmm,
there was a lot more anima to go around.
Right. Right. Well, and also, renders and vitals would have vastly contributed to the anima, because they are beings of basically pure anima.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were the seeders of anima. Things have anima because they went through and basically brought it about. Specifically the vitals. The renders, which were beings of mostly just movers and shapers of the world itself, had more of a resulting impact on crystalline structures. And actually, we should add this to the episode ideas because I think that there was something really potent with renders and vitals now. But the vitals specifically, I think, would have affected Gaia's nature, or maybe she was like the mother of them. If we had that one being that was known as like the architect of the worlds, or specifically of Sidar, the maker that was put in place that then kind of falls into existence in Orconis, I think that maybe there's something to be said for the vitals having an associate with the with Gaia's the nature.
Gaia. I agree.
Yeah.
Let me, I've got a good simile for this, or a metaphor. Don't
sure,
know which.
Yeah.
Or analogy. So, do you know who Bob Ross is?
Yeah. Yes, I
do. You know
his
style of painting?
Uh-huh.
So he puts on a clear coat on the canvas first, right?
Okay.
So I think the architect basically puts on the clear coat, mm-hmm. and then Gaia paints with the vitals the painting.
Yeah, okay, and I'm kind of thinking, so we talked before about renders and vitals and their relationship to the architect, or whoever this being is. I think that maybe there's a duality here where the architect was the overseer of the renders and Gaia was the overseer of the vitals.
Yes. And if you remember, the architect did have form.
Right. And so
and
then
their
Gaia
dead body does exist.
It would make sense that Gaia would. Sorry, what'd you say?
And their dead body does still exist.
Right. And so then Gaia's also would. I kind of like that. Okay. Also, side note. Not even a side note, because we're going to figure out how to weave this. I think this all does inform lycanthropy. I think there's actually very important bones here that are being structured, because so much of the ideas of lycanthropy have to do with humanity, at least in metaphors, relationship to the wild, the idea of wilderness and nature and a primordial past. And I think all of this is going to help inform this, because then we bring in the moons and the lunar cycles into this, and I'm curious to see where that goes. But before we finish this, there is one last thing, and maybe we just need to make a separate episode about the architect and Gaia, and maybe giving the architect a name. Do you want to do a gender duality or not? Because I think I want to stray away from that. I think that that's very easily done, and I had even previously seen Gaia as a gendered entity.
Yeah,
I'd kind of be cool.
Don't want to do a gender dichotomy.
Yeah, I kind of want to stay away, especially because it's so done to death, the idea of, you know, the architect or the one who is objective, you know, creating the rocks and the stones and the structure and all of that thing that is subjective, right? And then the matronly spirit coming in and filling it with life, you know, the subjective, the emotional.
Yeah, because
I kind of don't want to do that.
Yeah, let's not do that, because Gaia also represents the savagery and brutality of nature.
Right. And people 15 or 20 years ago who thought that they were woke would have said, and that is the feminine spirit, truly a powerful, visceral, rageful thing. And I'm like, yeah, let's not do that. How about...
Yeah, let's not do that. That's gross.
Especially because we're talking about a world where some creatures have 50,000 genders and are sentient, sapient beings.
Yeah.
Okay, to bring this all back in, though, there's definitely a relationship here with Gaia, with the Veldt, and the reason of it surviving. So I think that that relates to the circle of the land, the first druidic circle, which is the one discovered there. I think that there is something... It kind of reminds me of the story of... Oh, who was it in the Bible? I want to say it's maybe... It's not Lot. It's maybe one of Noah's children, or somebody becomes an outcast.
Yeah, Cain.
Cain, yeah. And how Cain, even in the outcastness, there's still some sort of like provision that God provides for him, that even so, you will still have access to some of my glory or something like that. There's something going on. It's been forever since I've read that story, but there's this idea of being, they've already been kicked out of the garden, and then Cain kills his brother, Abel, and I can see a relationship between that, and there's obviously very Eden-like things that we're drawing on with the Veldt, and this idea,
yes,
of an idyllic pasture land, a place of greenery in a world of barrenness. And so then it makes me wonder, from there is, I think, this ousting of the family, maybe even a banishment, and
definitely
it makes
banishment.
Me think that maybe the moons were a sort of provision, a nevertheless, even though you are outcast, there shall be one thing, a weak, you know, a wan light for you to still draw from, something like that.
Maybe the only time they can sate their hunger is upon the full moon, when they take upon beast shape and consume the flesh of the creatures.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I was going to even go darker, but you're going a little lighter, so that's nice.
What were you thinking?
I was thinking, like, and, you know, once they're in, you know, they can never, be satisfied with this hunger. And, a part of the ritual was them, the community throwing, spoiled food at them because they had left. So their food was stockpiled, and some of it had even spoiled. They had been stockpiling for so long. And so they throw this at them. And a part of the curse was that the only food that could ever give them any comfort from this everlasting hunger was spoiled, meat. And eating it, they'd just, vomit it back up. But they'd still try to eat it because it's the only thing that gives them
Because it's the only thing that they had for nourishment.
Yeah, so I was going further.
Okay. Well, I think that the two things can still be connected. I am curious. Do you think that they remained in the Veldt? Do you think that they were straight up ousted?
I think they were straight up ousted.
Okay.
And then, it was, a 100 years later, it was considered to be a master hunter of the Veldt. You had to, skin a werewolf.
Do you think that the family kept on trying to get back in? Is that the story you're kind of painting here? Is that they remained close-ish to the Veldt?
Yeah, I definitely think they strayed on the edges, and they just had to avoid being killed by the Bounders.
Okay. It definitely... Bounders. Did you just throw that in there? I like that.
Well, I mean, that's a Lord of the Rings term.
Okay. I should have known. Foolish me. I walked right into that.
Yep, the Hobbit, the Shire has Bounders, I believe.
Okay. I what I will say is I like this evokes the image of dogs eating from the scraps of a table. There's a rich feasting table and this clan of werewolf families or family, clan of peoples, they are trying to stick to the edges of this mountain range or whatever that is protecting, Gaia and the Veldt. And I think that they are occasionally fortunate enough to see creatures, animals or things, and that's where the hunting comes in, is that occasionally things escape from the Veldt. Rarely ever do things come in, but I can imagine that maybe some, animals are leaving. And so it's like they're just barely surviving off of those small odds.
And another part of it I like is that, imagine as an adventurer, Avon Quartus or Avon Quintus, whenever, Avon Tertius, and going into, a werewolf's den, and they're just being, rotting meat everywhere. It's just, really creepy, disgusting, unnatural place.
Especially because I like that as being something that is a telltale sign. If there's a lot of rotting meat, there's this idea, it suggests then, that this is how it was when it started, was that they were only given the rotting meat. But now, it is a result of over-hunting, hunting to a unnatural amount. Wolf packs are efficient. They'll only take down deer that they actually need to eat. They don't leave... If they do have leftovers, there's at least carrion to eat it up. But I like this idea of, werewolves eating to an engorged level, and even when, this is maybe a little gross, but maybe they even throw it up and they continue to eat because their hunger literally cannot be satiated.
Yeah. I like it.
Okay, so this is a really cool narrative, and I like this as being a legacy of the werewolves, this idea of overhunting to a dangerous extent. I think there are stabilized versions of this discovered later, where there's, if not a cure, a way to at least remain sapient and aware of your surroundings and still connected to the world. I think that it's difficult and it's not a guaranteed thing to as a way to heal from this. Question.
Here's a question. Oh
yeah, you go. You go ahead.
Given that there's at this beginning there's a very small number of werewolves,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's still a practice by the halflings?
Being a werewolof as lycanthropy, as something practiced?
you know, as something like the ritual employed by the halflings is still something that's done to, like, the worst of criminals.
Hmm.
And it's, like, a really, like, dark secret of the halfling community.
If it is... Oh, I'm kind of curious. I don't know if I entirely want to answer one way or another, because I think... Here's how I'll address this. Publicly, it is something that the common halfling, pastoral as they are, shudders to think about, and most deny tales of it ever even being a thing. I think that most halflings scoff at the idea that they were ever even druids. That is a little bit too much excitement for them.
Yeah.
I think that there are some who actually, the same kind of halfling who gets a glint in their eye whenever a minstrel strikes up a song about adventurers, likes to talk openly even about their druidic origins, and, you know, maybe that, you know, there are some in the family who say, oh, that is simply not done, you know, like, you don't, you know, why do you talk about such base things? But I think that there are some who are excited by that idea of our, in the same way that I think peoples, especially of the British Isles, can connect back to their druidic roots, or the people of, you know, the Franks can connect back to it. I would imagine, though, maybe it is still around as a ritual. I think if it is, it is something that is denied on all levels, even the people who are doing it. And I think most halfling society isn't even aware that it is. If it is this deep, dark secret, it's something that only people in the most closest, deepest circles are aware of.
I agree. To like 110-year-old halflings.
Yeah, yes. Okay, question. This is what I was wondering. Why lycanthropy? Why specifically a wolf, and why be a curse that you transform into this thing? And is this something that was done to them as punishment for their crimes, or was the outcasting done first and the werewolf, the lycanthropy, came later? Were they kicked out and then maybe that warped the way that they wild shaped, or they sought the strength of the land, but being cut off from Gaia, they had to seek the moon or something like that. And then as a result, there was some sort of magic gone wrong. Did they do it to themselves? Or was this something that was done specifically as ritual? Because I kind of like the idea of them doing it to themselves even more.
Yeah, I do like that idea. But it also is pretty interesting to think of, like, the wolf as righteous justice for them. You know, they were wolves in their community. They took care of their pack and didn't have a care for the other sheep around them.
Or even, yeah, kind of saying, like, so, you know, as you acted as wolves, so shall you be wolves.
Exactly. So I like that, but I also like the idea that maybe they developed it, but then, like, you know, like, if it was like something gone wrong. I like the idea that the halflings cursed them with this, and then other halflings, you know, farther down the line were like, you know, we don't have to just use this kind of magic as a curse. We can use it ourselves in a different way to become animals for a short time.
Yeah. So do you are you saying that they might have been the first beast shapers?
Yeah, I think that the first beast shapers were the lycanthropy, and then from there the circle of the moon came from, you know, an understanding of the ritual and taking it a step lower instead of this lifelong permanent curse. It's a small connection to the moon that is
perfected. They did the magic properly, because I do like this narrative, and it does make a lot of sense. Here's something, let me add to this, because this is something I was thinking, was while you were saying all of that, I was imagining actually a different scenario, but I think that the two might actually weave in together. I was thinking, what if, imagine that wild shaping and beast shape was already a thing during this time, and each family had a different patron creature that they could turn into. And so there was like a clan of you know, moles, or another clan of wolves, and a clan of bears, and a clan of, you know, these different clans. And they were able to, beast shape, and maybe that magic malfunctioned or something when they left the realm of the circle of the land. And so as a result, trying to cast those same spells without access to Gaia, they tried to access the moon, and it cursed them with this unstable form and stuff. However, I do like the idea of them being the first beast shapers. Were they?
Yeah, because with your story, we don't really get a connection between regular wild shapers in the moon.
Right.
Only with lycanthropy.
Right. Well, technically, all druids can wild shape, but I do think that is something that maybe comes later, like an Avum Tertius thing, once magic is more abound and people have time to perfect things. People have the resources to perfect them.
That is true. All druids can wild shape. That is true.
But so that was my initial thought, but let me complicate it with this. I think instead of it being something where they were able to wild shape during the time in the grove, in the veldt, it was something instead where they were like characteristic traits. They weren't actually turning into these animals, but they had like aspects of the wolf or aspect of, you know, the bear or something like that. And it's sort of almost like a spirit guide, a spirit animal for those different clans. And so this is the wolf clan. This is the bear clan. This is the, I don't know, maybe fox. Not tiger, but fox. Yeah, fox would be a great one. You know, and not all of them are necessarily hunters. Maybe there are some who are the
turkey clan.
Yeah. I was going to say the blue jay, but I like turkey more. But then as a result, something gets perverted in that when they're ousted.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah. And they start to become the thing, you know, these traits become exhibited more greatly. So yeah, do they just reach into the moon? Was moon magic something, lunar magic was something that they had been trying to accomplish more recently, but then were they the first to try and do lunar magic when they were reaching out? And so to remind me again, because we've jumped around a lot, in your mind, did we end up with them cursing themselves or them being cursed by the community to become like wolves?
We haven't decided yet.
Okay. They were ousted.
They were definitely ousted.
I think that maybe when they were ousted, there was a ritualized magic, a sharing of a circle that did actually place a curse on them and saying basically, so it was your nature, so shall you be forever.
Yes.
These werewolves. I think that does actually make sense to me. You shall, you know, only be guided by the moon and stuff. And that was when that curse was placed on them. Maybe they used lunar magic to bind it or something like that.
I think maybe the part of the curse was like, you know, you can never hide from the curse as it is, you know, as the moons will always face you or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Under the watchful eyes of the sisters, you shall never be rid of this curse, kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you agree with me? Do you feel good about that idea of them bringing in lunar magic to address this?
Yes.
Okay.
I like the idea of a kind of, you know, the Veldt and halflings as druids using lunar magic, you know, and maybe some sort of weird prism technique to break apart and, you know, get the magic in the light in a way that you can't do with the sun, with the audio.
Yeah. Well, and I think, remind me, I think that we played with the idea of each one of the moon sisters being sort of a governess of a third of the nine flow.
Yes.
So maybe there's something even with specifically what moon is associated with you as a werewolf. Because this is something I was playing with. At first, it's something that's sitting in the back of my mind as we've talked about all of this is
the werewolf of charity and wisdom.
Or the perversions of those.
That's
right. So like whatever is the, you know, inversion or the abscess of stuff. So maybe they're defined
miserly
by the moons that aren't in the sky instead of the ones that are or something like that. You know, I thought there's a lot of different ways that we can do this because obviously traditionally werewolves are associated with a singular moon. And whenever that moon is up, then the magic happens. When I initially thought about, oh, what if they just are up whenever there's a full moon? Well, then we get more opportunities for werewolves to be out and about, you know, more than just a few nights.
I like the idea that there's some weird connection between them and the moons, and they may even become like more monstrous the more moons are up, like less like a regular wolf and more like a kind of weird hybrid.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was actually kind of thinking that.
So that, you know, if there is a 3 full moon night, it's like a big deal and these things are scary.
Which happens, I think, once every 7 years or so.
Exactly. So there's this big event that could be really cool.
Yeah, it's known as like the Night of the Wolves or something.
Yeah, and I like the idea that you still have werewolves, even if it's just one full moon, but we take away their ability to voluntarily change. Like maybe they can cast, like, you know, they have like an innate alter self where they can like grow claws and fangs, but they can't become like full wolf mode.
Okay. So you're saying any full moon it causes them to become more wolf like, but there's like maybe a patron moon or something that they are under the sign of. And once that moon is out, then it is like full bore. You're a werewolf.
Yeah, I mean, we could. I was thinking that any moon
makes them a werewolf.
Makes them a werewolf, but they can't voluntarily change. It's involuntary.
Because I was thinking about this, and I'm okay with that idea. That was my first thought. But here was the potential enhancement of that idea. We could end up with a situation where we have kind of different classes of werewolves in a way that you absolutely cannot get in the real world because there's only one moon. But in the world of Halume, I believe I don't remember the precise cycles. I believe they are 61, 30 something, or maybe 29 days and 15 days-ish around there. Or maybe it's even 10 days. So I was playing with the idea of what if there was... So the werewolves of Mayon would become werewolves every 10 days, which is either good or bad. I'm not really sure yet. But like in this situation, it'd be like... They maybe aren't so far gone. They are still werewolves, but their hunger is something that they can kind of at least control to some extent. But the greater the moon, the more intense the pull and the longer that the full moon stay out. So a Mayon werewolf in this situation would only be a werewolf for like, you know, one night or so of every 10 day. But a Gamaliel werewolf, which would be like every 30 days or so, our typical one, would have a couple of days like it would be in the stories that happen in the real world, versus a Hadariel one would be absolutely destruction in fur and flesh. And it would be so for a solid like 5, maybe even six nights straight, something like that.
Yeah, that could be interesting.
So that was the idea anyways.
Could associate them with different animals. This is where you're were tigers and you're were bears.
Well, and that's a whole other question is are all of these... Do you think that the thropy, the turning into an animal, whatever it is, prefix thropy, of these different animals, do you think they're also associated with the moon?
I think shape-changing in general is associated with the moon.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that. I was just checking in on that because I was trying to think, is lycanthropy special to them? No, I think that, yeah, where any animal that's or thing that's an incomplete transformation is, I think, something that happens due to the moon cycles. But are you saying then that there's only like 3 different versions of this?
No. I'm just saying that there could be like... You could associate, like, certain animals with certain moons. You know, this is just a raw idea.
Okay.
But maybe, you know, maybe some, like, maybe werebears just get it when there's a triple moon, triple threat. Because werebears in D&D are funny because they're actually chaotic good.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're actually quite nice people.
Oh, well, I love bears, so that's fine with me. Bears are the best.
Yeah, they're good lads. But they generally stay away from people because, you know, they're like anthropes.
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. As far as the lycanthropy is concerned, I am very engaged with the idea of the different classes and things, especially because it then suggests lore and legends around the different communities of werewolves and what clan are you under? Are you, or what moon are you under? You know, what moon do you serve? Is there, and each one, maybe there's even those who choose, who seek out lycanthropy and can find different clans and seek out a specific sign over other ones. And there's almost like rituals and rites of passage. And there might be, I can think about the different cultural interactions, the plays of politics that happen between the werewolves of Mayon sign versus Hadariel sign versus Gamaliel sign. I think that all moons affect them, but I think it becomes a universal in a way that maybe it doesn't have to be. Maybe I'm only struggling to see a picture without that, but it becomes having all werewolves become werewolves on the night of any full moon. Yeah, it becomes universal in a way that's not as interesting to me and also not as Halloumian, I think.
Yeah, we can do the class stuff. I just, your picture of werewolves seems very organized, which is a bit strange. Because, you know, they have, like, clans and they have politics. I'm like, they're werewolves, dude.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, well, maybe what it is they are werewolves. I mean, they're only werewolves for a couple of nights. That's the thing. Is like, for the rest of the time, they are normal knowing beings.
Yeah, but it still affects them, right? The curse is not just a night thing. It's they still feel it.
Well, absolutely. But, like, I don't know. I think about typical werewolf literature or in, you know, tropes and things, and I think about the packs that they form. You know, that's a pretty common idea, is the idea of a lone wolf is a specific idea. Yes. And our sense of what it means to have a pack is like, you know, has also a very specific idea.
Yeah, I'm with you on the idea of packs, but I think that most between pack politicking is violent.
Okay. I'm right? Okay with that.
Packs aren't friends with each other.
Here's maybe what it is. Maybe the wolves of Hadariel and Gamaliel are more increasingly feral, even in their normal state, than the wolves of Mayon. Maybe the Mayon wolves are like the ones that are the closest to being quote unquote civilized. They have like a structure and an order. They see werewolves as sort of like a beautiful tragedy. You know, there's like, we are cursed with this, but it also increases our strength, and there's almost a nobility and a pride that they maybe take in their blood curse. But then there are the there are the ones of Gamaliel and Hadariel. I think the ones of Hadariel are, they may have some form of a structure, a bureaucracy is the wrong word, but of clan hierarchy, but it is so close to, it is far closer to alphas and just the idea of pack structure as wolves. They're like more far gone. Everything is, they speak less, their words are short and simple, and their entire lives are focused around the pack and just caring for the pack.
I think that if there's a lone werewolf, it's going to be Big Moon. Big Moon.
Hadariel?
That's the one. Big Moon.
Sure. Yeah, well, and I think the idea of, even within these clans, I like the idea that some of them still haven't let go of the traditions of the halflings, and that there are some who push against it and say that there are some things you do not do. There are crimes against our own kind that are, you know, have you learned, you know, kind of, have you learned nothing from our legends? And they will push them out, and then those become lone wolves who are packless.
Oh, yeah.
I also like the idea of like surrogate packs, where it's like some of the outcasts form between different moons and they look after each other, even though they're like, of different signs.
Ooh, what do they call it? When it's It's like Honor Among Thieves kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Packs there's definitely that vibe. There's still rules among the pack, even when they're packless. They're alone yes. together, that idea.
Yeah.
So, okay, question, because obviously, you know, we're getting up there in time. I'm good to keep going if you are.
Sure, yeah, I got another 10 minutes in me.
Because I was curious. I know, I'm only just fucking myself later when I have to go and edit this, but I was curious. Do you think it is something that is passed down by bloodline, or it is something that is ritual magic, or do you think it's both, or do you think it's... How does it continue?
I think it can be inherited through blood. It's only like, I think that it's like a 90% chance if they're two werewolves.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like a 40% chance if it's a werewolf and some other person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a chance if there's no werewolves involved.
Do you think, do you think a child of a werewolf who is not cursed by the disease can then like still carries it dormant? Or no? Do you think that they're just straight up clean of it? And it's like the curse has been broken for them? Because I kind of actually like that idea. I kind of like the idea that it's like if they're somehow fortunate enough, they're actually, there's almost a, it pains us to do this, our child, but you have been freed from the curse. We are going to put you with a different family. You know, we're going to find a family or, you know, have you be put into an orphanage or something because it is better for you to live that life or to live a life of having never known your parents than to be among pack when you do not have the curse.
Yes. 100%.
Wow. There's some good stories there.
I think it can be, of course, ritually cast. The curse can be placed on someone.
I agree.
But it's a secret.
Uh-huh. And like a secret from other spellcasters. I think it's not even written down or anything. Like it is shared across generations by maybe one or two. You know, there's like a lead ritualist and then there's an understudy who like learns how to do also this blood magic. But it is not even shared with the rest of the werewolf community for like fear that it would get out.
Yes. And I think the last thing with regard to can it be transferred through biting, I don't think it's so straightforward. I think there has to be a very specific circumstance.
Yeah. I don't really, I think that's more a vampire's game, I think, than werewolves. I think that werewolves, it's less interesting to me because vampires are a lot more...
sexy.
I was going to say organized. With everything that we've talked about with clan hierarchy and stuff, it's still more in the semblance of a wolf pack than, you know, of a bureaucracy or of an organization, of an empire, really. And I like the idea of it being an intentional choice to turn somebody else into a vampire and a very specific process. Whereas with the werewolves, yeah, I don't think a bite from a werewolf will turn you into that.
I think the only way is if you drink, like... concentrated werewolf blood.
I thought you were going to say concentrated werewolf pee for a second there.
Nope, blood.
I'm not even sure about that. I was honestly kind of just feeling like hereditary and ritual. Like
I think it's a ritual that the werewolves have themselves.
Do you think so?
I think that they have figured out a way to grant the curse. As you know, this is...
Well, isn't that what the ritual is?
I think the werewolves, I don't know if they have the ability to perform the ritual.
Oh. I was thinking that they did. Well, yeah, but it is like ritual casting, so it's not necessarily... I mean, there's still going to be people among them who are born with an affinity for magic, and honestly, if anything, I think that their connection to the moon might actually give them a greater likelihood that they're spellcasters. Because, yes, it is a curse, and this is one of the things I think that it carries with it. Yes, it gives them greater strength and endurance and healing, but also an affinity for magic that most people don't have, but only through their blood and only through the moons. And so, in a way, it's, I think...
I think there's a different tainted. Ritual between lycanthropes and a halfling.
Okay. So you're saying there's a ritual that, like, the halflings can do to turn somebody into a werewolf to oust them, but you think that there's a different ritual that the lycanthropes have to turn other people into werewolves?
Yes, it's different. But the end result is the same.
But why would it have to be different? Is kind of part of my question. It's like the same thing that would... I think the
werewolves didn't know how to do it. But the halflings recorded it, or, you know, kept it in oral tradition. And then the werewolves figured out a way on their own.
All right, you're kind of convincing me there. I can feel that. I can feel that.
I think it's a little bit more nitty gritty, using, like, you know, werewolf blood and, you know, weird howling.
I will say this. I think the one thing that I will push back against is I'm not as interested in seeing it come about as a result of drinking werewolf blood. I think that that's much more a vampire thing. I think drinking a vampire's blood is kind of like part of how you become a vampire or something like that. And also, like, the idea of drinking blood is something that is... This is something where when it comes to werewolves and vampires, I think that stuff gets a little bit too generic when things widen to that extent. Especially because we don't really see that in the spirit of a wolf, you know? Like, there's no... Like, wolves don't drink blood. They'll eat flesh and stuff like that. So maybe there's something in that, but
this?
Like...
Are you ready for this? I got a good one.
Yeah, what do you got?
They need a werewolf corpse. And you eat the flesh. How about that?
Is it living or dead? You know what? I think that the curse takes on a different form if it's living or dead. Like, I think there's something that's even further gone than a werewolf. Like, maybe it's like permanent werewolfness if it's dead. But if it's living flesh, and so people are actually taking out, like, a chunk of themselves to offer, I think that...
I like how gross it is, yes.
Yeah, I know. It's super gross. Like, just, like, peeling a part of your body. Or, like, I don't even know. Yeah, cutting a chunk of your own flesh off.
Bam.
Ooh. Especially because then there would be some really fucked up societies of werewolves where they keep basically, like, a surrogate who is always healing, but also always being, like, a chunk cut out. Because that's the part of it. They have, like, a Wolverine-esque, like, healing factor.
They so do, yeah.
If a chunk of activated werewolf is removed, then they can actually heal it back. But... Still, I mean, it's like really gross.
Yeah, but like if a werewolf in werewolf form consumes a dead werewolf, then they become super, super crazy.
I don't know. I think maybe they just get the equivalent of like rabies.
They get werewolf rabies.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. We should probably finish up here. Is there anything left that you wanted to explore?
Rare raccoons?
Werecoons are definitely a thing.
There you go.
I don't know. I think that this, like, staging of how far gone you are or how much you take on the nature of an animal is true for any were creature. And so there's, like, different groups that have these different thirds.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
How about you? Anything you want to take away?
Oh, if I have to pick just one. Okay, because there was one other thing. I'm just going to comment. This isn't even a question. I just like the fact that we have now associated halflings with something so feral and ancient. I really love that that's the duality that we're playing with here, is like civility that is really just a shroud, a placement. It is just them attempting to bury as deeply as they can sort of the corpse of their feral past.
Yes.
I think that's really fucking cool. I will say, I am curious, do you think, are there any werewolves under the sign of Fenislil?
This one's a weird one. Are there ghost werewolves?
Well, I mean, and then is there lunar iron? I mean, with all of that stuff, sea silver, all of those things put together. Because what is, isn't it silver bullets, silver weaponry?
It's silver weaponry. And I think that one of the reasons why it's called silver is that it is effective against werewolves.
Yeah. Although
besides,
I think that
it looks like it.
In this situation, I don't think it's literally like Argentine silver, you know, like our world silver. I think it's sea silver or lunar iron that can deal with them.
Or you think that no other silver that can deal with them?
I don't think so. I think that it has to be lunar iron.
Well, now lunar iron is effective against ghosts and werewolves.
I think it depends on how you tune it. But doesn't that make sense? Like, there's almost something about Fenislil undoing the curse or something like that?
The hair of the dog.
Yeah, maybe it can even heal them if it's done correctly, or if there's a way of bringing about the sea silver into the ritual. But I think that it can straight up just kill them too.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's definitely like, you know, you can cure a vampire by driving a wooden stake through their heart or something.
Yeah, cured.
Yeah.
Now cured. They're not a vampire anymore, or a living, or undead, or whatever they were.
I think there was a way to cure a vampire where, like, you do, because staking them actually just paralyzes them.
Oh, really? It doesn't actually kill them?
In D&D.
Moving water, rushing water, or something like that can kill a vampire?
That does kill them. Because D&D goes with the older vampire stuff. And staking them paralyzes them.
That's right. Yeah. And then you just got to get them into a river or something.
Or the sun.
Or the sun. Yeah, that too. Just, just turn into wisps. But okay, just really quickly though, so to come back to it, do you think there are any of the Lost Moon of Fenislil?
I don't know, man.
I think they're a legend. I think even among werewolves, they're a legend. To know whether they exist or not is... The real question is how would they even exist, you know?
Yeah. The Platinum Dragon. It's a legend.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. Yes, it is a legend. Very good. Well, I think that's pretty much it for this week, then.
We hope you've enjoyed this exploration to the lands of Siddhar and the realms beyond. If you like us, give us a 5-star rating, or better yet, tell others about us. Tell your werewolf friends, tell your goth friends, tell your cannibal friends?
Your Hot Topic friends. Let your neighbor who's really into gardening know.
Maybe... Your really hairy friend?
Friends who keep rabbits. Warn them.
That's your turn, Frank.
The pause was just long enough for me to realize. Each week, we offer a piece of the episode to share with you, the listener, meaning that your contributions can become Helluvian canon. It's time to decide what's our offering this week, Carter, because we covered a lot of shit here.
Yeah, I think like, what are some, like, we have 3 different classes of werewolves. So you can tell us, like, what each one might look like. You know, one of them's maybe going to be scrawnier, one of them's going to be, like, a beef boy. Maybe, like, what are other lycanthropes look like a werehare or a were panda?
Yeah. Do their features, do they have specific features, you know? Describe these clans to us. Are there is there some telltale sign of like a tuft ear or something like that gives away directly that they are a werewolf?
You can send your responses to @TheLoreKeepers on Twitter, or email us at lorekeeperspodcast@gmail.com with your idea for this week's offering. Our Twitter is also a great place to find dank nugs, news, and musings on the world of Hallowmay, and our email is perfect for questions of all sizes you'd like for us to address.
Finally, thanks to Josh Silker for his composition of Land of Heroes, the Lorekeeper's theme. And thanks to you all for listening.
Until next time, don't forget, there are always more moons to howl at.
Woo!
Bye.
Bye.